You're listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, online at kpfa.org. The time is now 1 p.m. Up next is Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
And then you have to ask yourself, when you look at that picture where they, you know, with all the heads of state and heads of government there embracing and holding hands, the whole bunch of war criminals in there, in the front lines, okay? People who have ordered the bombings of sovereign countries. And then, of course, there's the Prime Minister of Israel who's there, who's a terrorist. What is implied in that is that this community of heads of state and heads of government, which is responsible for terror acts and for supporting, covertly supporting and financing jihadists. They're funded by the United States, Turkey and Israel and so on and so forth. And then we have to ask ourselves, we have here an issue of state sponsorship of terrorism.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, who was behind the Paris attacks? Michelle Chosadovsky is an economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, and America's War on Terrorism. His most recent articles are The Attacks on Charlie Hebdo and the Kosher Grocery Store, Israel's Mossad to the Rescue, and Police Commissioner Involved in Charlie Hebdo Investigation Commits Suicide, Total News Blackout. Today we discuss the unspoken truth supported by France, anomalies in the terrorist attacks in Paris and police investigation, state-sponsored terrorism, and the larger global geopolitical framework. Michelle Chosadovsky, good to talk to you again.
Delighted to be on the program.
12 people were killed in Paris in a military-style attack on Charlie Hebdo, a newspaper known for running cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. According to McClatchy News Service, quote, the terror attack wasn't a total surprise. Europe, France, and even the newspaper have been preparing for such an attack for months. End quote. The suspects, two brothers, Saeed and Sherif Kouachi, French of Algerian descent, were reportedly gunned down near Charles de Gaulle Airport. A third suspect, Amadi Koulibaly, French of African descent, took 10 hostages in a kosher supermarket in Paris and was also killed by police. According to the New York Times, quote, the militants had been known to the police for years and had been closely monitored by the intelligence services, end quote. Where would you start in trying to understand these terrorist attacks?
Well, the first issue, I think, which is absolutely crucial if we want to understand so-called jihadism or Islamic terrorism, is that the United States and its allies have been supporting the jihadist movement, these terrorist cells, since 1979, since the onslaught of the Soviet-Afghan War. Amply documented, the French Republic, under the helm of President François Hollande, is supporting as well as funding Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists in Iraq and Syria, as well as providing covert intelligence support to Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorist cells within France and the European Union. And I think what we have to emphasize there in the media's coverage of these tragic events is that there is a forbidden truth. Namely, the French public has not or is not aware, despite the fact that it's amply documented in the European media, that their own government, together with the United States, NATO and Israel, while waging a self-proclaimed war on terrorism, are routinely providing covert support to to the same terrorist entities which are the object of their both their humanitarian wars as well as their counterterrorism operations, both at home and abroad. So that in effect what is happening now is that the French media in chorus are pointing to the jihadists. And in that regard, they're also supported by the Netanyahu government. And they say that the jihadists are a threat to freedom of expression. But in fact, freedom of expression really has been curtailed as a result of this event, because not a single French media has had the courage of raising the broader issue of state sponsorship of terrorism and the role that the French government and its intelligence services have played in supporting Al-Qaeda affiliated entities at home and abroad.
How were these suspects so readily identified?
Well, this is something which is somewhat mysterious, because there's no evidence to the fact that the terrorists who attacked Charlie Hebdo are the same people as those who have been identified as suspected terrorists. As you mentioned, both Koulibaly as well as the Kouachi brothers have been on the radar of French and European security services, for years now, okay? They're not unknown, and I would say that they are intelligence assets. But there's certain very troubling issues pertaining to what actually happened. And the fact that a lot of this is denied or simply not covered by the mainstream media. First is the fact that one of the suspects lost his ID in the car, in the getaway car, and it was picked up by the security services. Well, that's sort of a deja vu kind of occurrence. I mean, just so happens you lose your ID there, and then the ID points to the name of the terrorist. That's one dimension. But the other dimension is that one of the main suspects, Koulibaly, actually back in 2009 had a meeting behind closed doors with the President of the Republic, namely in that time it was Sarkozy. Okay? Now, you ask yourself, well, why is it that this individual, who is in a sense a sort of marginalized person, marginalized in terms of employment opportunities, in terms of education, struggling to survive in a ghetto and so on and so forth, how is it that this person would have met the President of the Republic behind closed doors? Now, I mention that because I think it's something which the media hasn't acknowledged. It's an issue which is confirmed by a press report in 2009, and we've brought that thing up. It's obviously relevant to this investigation. So there are lots of inconsistencies in the official narrative and in press coverage. Another issue which I was particularly concerned with is that one of the senior police officers in Southwest France, in the department of in the region of Haute-Vienne, the capital of which is Limoges, was actually part of the investigation team, and he was actually. Well, I surmise that he was asked to participate in this investigation because the Kouachi brothers actually spent their high school years, in that region. They had lived in that region, and presumably his office based in Limoges was contacted by Paris and then said, well, could you look into this matter? The reports are so scanty, we can't say anything definitive on that matter. But the issue is that police commissioner is reported to have returned to his office on the same day when the attacks occurred. That was on the Wednesday. He went back to his office. Visibly, his investigation was local, okay? It was not in Paris by any means. Well, I should mention, this individual, ultimately, this police officer who was commissioned to undertake an investigation, actually committed suicide. And the circumstances of his suicide are the following. On Wednesday, as part of the Charlie Hebdo investigation, he dispatched a team of police officials under his jurisdiction, okay? And then he is reported to have waited for their return, the return of his team for debriefing. And immediately following the police debriefing, he was involved in preparing his police report. Now, that's reading between the lines of the scanty regional press reports, because none of the mainstream media, including Associated Press, Agence France-Presse, Reuters, Deutsche Welle, none of the European media, US media, none of the French dailies actually reported. And they waited until Monday to actually acknowledge that this took place. And the reports that I've seen from the regional press, which nobody reads actually, it's sort of local, what they say is that this guy was stressed. He had problems with his work. He was close to burnout, and so on and so forth. And he spontaneously killed himself at 1 a.m, within hours of the police debriefing. Now, they also say about this individual, police commissioner Elric Fredou, they say that he went to visit one of the families of the victims. Now, we assume that those families were in his jurisdiction, which is about 400 kilometers, 300 miles, let's say, from Paris. And I haven't been able to find any evidence of him having contacted the family of one of the victims. But the official story is that he met the family of the victims and then he got really depressed and ultimately committed suicide. Now, we've seen this kind of suicide or accidental death of police officers. The Boston bombing, as you recall, two of the FBI officials who were involved in the Boston bombing investigation concerning the Tsarnaev brothers, well, they accidentally fell off a helicopter, both of them together, okay? Now, the issue is, did police commissioner Helric Fredou commit suicide? Was he incited to commit suicide? Or was he an honest cop who was executed from within his, you know, the France's judicial police system? The thing is that if there had been freedom of expression in French journalism, you would have had a whole bunch of journalists who would have jumped on the opportunity. It's called investigative reporting, and they would have come out with some understanding of what happened. And that's not what happened, because what happened was that his suicide, one of the main investigating police officials, there are probably many of them, but he was still within his region. He was in charge of that. Well, it was simply presented as something totally unrelated to the Charlie Hebdo investigation. They barely acknowledged the fact that he was actually involved in the investigation and that he just so happened to commit suicide and have a burnout and was suffering from depression. Okay, so that's another, there are many of these very unusual circumstances, an ID discovered in the car leading to a suspect, a police commissioner committing suicide, a kosher grocery store. Now, that's another element. The kosher grocery store, because it was used by Prime Minister Netanyahu as a pretext and a justification to send SWAT police forces and Mossad agents to France to work hand in glove with their French colleagues.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, who was behind the Paris attacks? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Isn't that quite unusual for another country, or is it not unusual for another country to send their own intelligence agencies and SWAT teams into another country to investigate a criminal act there?
Well, they were at the moment of the attacks. There were some reports to the fact that Mossad was involved. I have to rectify. There's absolutely no evidence of Mossad involvement at the time of these attacks. Nor is there evidence of Mossad presence in France prior to these attacks. But I think that if we are to analyze the role of Mossad from a propaganda point of view, we have to address the fact that, first of all, the French police had launched raids on the kosher grocery in a Jewish neighborhood in Paris, which is Porte de Vincennes. Everybody knows where Porte de Vincennes is. It's at the exit of Paris, and it's near Parc de Vincennes. Now, the reaction of the Israeli government is the following. Prime Minister Netanyahu confirmed on January 9, that's last Friday, okay, the dispatch of an Israeli police SWAT team unit, which was slated to work in liaison with its French counterparts. So the Israeli SWAT unit was, quote, specializing in siege situations and rescue, and it is, again, quote, on standby, ready to travel to Paris to assist the French authorities resolve the siege of the kosher grocery store. Okay, so the grocery store is, in a sense, it has a sort of symbolic meaning there, but it points to the fact that there's some kind of a Jewish entity in Paris at Porte de Vincennes is threatened. And consequently, Israel has a responsibility to come to the rescue of the Jewish community in France. Now, we don't have any evidence as to prior presence of these Israeli SWAT teams in Paris, but we have evidence that Prime Minister Netanyahu made this far-reaching statement. But there's something else, because in addition to the SWAT teams, okay, Prime Minister Netanyahu also ordered Mossad to provide French officials, I'm quoting again, Prime Minister Netanyahu, quote, has ordered Mossad to provide French officials for all the assistance they need in tackling the ongoing terror situation in and around Paris, okay? And that's a quote from the Daily Telegraph. And essentially what this suggests is that Prime Minister Netanyahu has made his position official. Now, I would suspect that if he had ordered Mossad to provide French officials for all the assistance they needed, that was last Friday on January 9, well, I would suspect that there might well have been Mossad agents on French soil prior to the official statement, because France and Israel have a long-standing partnership. In other words, it's the partnership between Mossad and the Direction Générale de la Sécurité Extérieure. And previously it was called Le Deuxième Bureau, the Second Bureau. It's French intelligence. And they've been working in tandem for years. But you see, what Netanyahu actually said, it's very important from a sort of ideological perspective, from a propaganda perspective. He said, and I quote, the attacks on Charlie Hebdo and the Paris kosher grocery store are a microcosm of a greater battle against jihadists. Okay? This is a global struggle, And then he says, that's very interesting, bring to justice the Paris murderers is just the beginning. And as we know, they were all killed. They were suspects. They weren't even, there was no proof that these people were actually behind the attacks. They were suspects. But they made sure that they were dead, okay? They killed them. Even though Prime Minister Netanyahu said, bring them to justice. But in Israel, they don't bring people to justice either. And then he says, and all of them seek to destroy our freedoms and to impose on all of us a violent medieval tyranny. They may have different names, but all of them are driven by the same hatred and bloodthirsty fanaticism. They bomb churches in Iraq, they slaughter tourists in Bali, they rocket civilians from Gaza, and strive to build nuclear weapons in Iran. We have to fight these enemies of our common civilization. So it really is an appeal by the Israeli Prime Minister using this event to wage a massive propaganda campaign to turn realities upside down, because again the crimes in Iraq and Palestine are committed by the Western military alliance and Israel. We know that, and the irony is that Prime Minister Netanyahu confirms, and this was back in just less than a year ago, that the IDF, the so-called Israeli Defense Force, actually supports Al-Qaeda terrorists, which are deployed in Syria through a base, a logistics base in the Golan Heights. Okay? And again, if you want to start looking at a play of words, I'll quote from the Jerusalem Post, and it says, Northern Command Major General Yair Golan briefed Netanyahu on the presence of global jihad elements inside Syria, as well as on the work being done to fortify the Israeli border fence. Now, what they are saying essentially is that we support the jihadists in Syria. Okay, we support those terrorists because they're fighting the secular government of Bashar al-Assad. And we are providing them with money and logistics and so on and so forth, training. Mossad is involved in that as well. And we condemn, in other words, Netanyahu condemns jihadism, but he acknowledges global jihad elements inside Syria supported by the state of Israel. And then you have to ask yourself, when you look at that picture where they, you know, with all the heads of state and heads of government there embracing and holding hands, the whole bunch of war criminals in there, in the front lines, okay? People who have ordered the bombings of sovereign countries, Iraq and Syria and Libya and so on. And then, of course, there's the Prime Minister of Israel who's there, who's a terrorist. And okay, so what is implied in that is that this community of heads of state and heads of government, which is responsible for terror acts and for supporting, covertly supporting and financing jihadists in complicity also with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and so on. We know they're trained there, they're recruited. They even recruited from Saudi prisons. Then they're set loose in Syria. They're funded by the United States, Turkey, and Israel, and so on and so forth. And then we have to ask ourselves, we have here an issue of state sponsorship of terrorism. The French Republic, under François Hollande, okay, is supporting as well as funding Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations in the Middle East, in North Africa, in liaison with US, NATO, and Israel, and at the same time, it is presenting itself as a government committed to democracy, etc., etc., secular democracy. Those are the things which are simply not addressed. While the French media in chorus points to the threat directed against freedom of expression in journalism, namely Charlie Hebdo, Je suis Charlie Hebdo, not a single French media has had the courage of pointing to the issue of state sponsorship of terrorism by Western governments, but also by their own French government, which has funded the al-Nusra and the Islamic State terrorists in Syria and Iraq. And we know that the Islamic State is an instrument of the Western military alliance, and that allied intervention in Iraq is not going after the Islamic State brigades, which could have been liquidated, you know, when they cross the desert from Syria into Iraq. It's open territory. And they go in with their Toyota convoys. They could be eliminated. That's very, very clear. They're not interested in that. They're interested in bombing a sovereign country, destroying its infrastructure, and ultimately picking up the pieces, because these countries have very large oil reserves, which are, of course, slated to be transferred into the hands of the oil conglomerates.
Well, yes, there are reports of the U.S. dropping food and other supplies to these so-called ISIS fighters. As well, I've read about Senator John McCain sneaking somehow into the area to meet with these militants.
Well, absolutely. We've got so much evidence to the fact that the Islamic State is supported by the CIA. In fact, I mean, the Islamic State is a creation of the CIA. So that right from the outset, let's say in March of 2011, I'm talking about the outset of the so-called civil war in Syria, those brigades, the Salafist al-Qaeda brigades that entered from Jordan and from Turkey, they were protected right from day one by the Western military alliance, and of course also by the State of Israel. And we even know that they were equipped in the use of chemical weapons. But despite the fact that the chemical weapons issue was then used by the Obama administration to place the blame on the government of Bashar al-Assad, blaming the government of killing its own people, when in fact it's amply documented that these terrorists, supported by the West, jihadist elements, are an instrument of the Western military alliance. They are the foot soldiers of the Western military alliance, and they're sent in to create havoc and to undermine and destroy a sovereign country.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, who is behind the Paris attacks? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. In your article, The Attacks on Charlie Hebdo and the Kosher Grocery Store, Israel's Mossad to the Rescue, you have a picture of Netanyahu shaking hands with a wounded mercenary in the occupied Golan Heights. And you've discussed Israel's involvement with the jihadists in Syria. What about recent United Nations vetoes of Palestinian membership in the ICC, the International Criminal Court? Does the situation of the Palestinians figure in the Paris attacks?
Well, you see, I think that's certainly an element. Now, some analysts have raised this issue. The position of the U.S. government, as we saw in the United Nations Security Council, was simply to veto Palestinian statehood, and also to say that if Palestine were to seek membership in the ICC, they would face a curtailment of U.S. aid to Palestine. And so that, in effect, there you have a Palestinian entity seeking statehood, which wants to become member of an international criminal court, like many other countries. There are more than 100 countries are members, and that is considered to be an aggressive act on the part of Palestine. Palestine hasn't said what they're going to do at the ICC. They simply want to become members. But it, of course, raises the fact, amply documented, that that Israel has committed extensive war crimes. Now, I should mention, I was member of the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Commission, which waged a legal procedure against the State of Israel. And a judgment was made pointing to the responsibility of the State of Israel as well as several members of the government as responsible for war crimes. Those war crimes are not committed by, they're certainly executed by soldiers and military operatives, but ultimately the war criminals are those who actually give the orders. And so that we're dealing with Prime Minister Netanyahu, the Defense Minister, Moshe Yalon, and other senior officials of the Israeli government who are responsible for extensive war crimes against the Palestinian people, not only recently, but historically, going back to Sabra Shatila. And there have been many procedures, but now the fact that the United States would say, we're going to veto that because we don't want the Palestinians, we don't accept the fact that Israel could be subjected to a war crimes procedure. And so they're penalizing them and cutting off the flow of foreign aid. And so that, in effect, the United States shows that it's complicit in U.S. war crimes. But now the issue with regard to France is that France voted in favor, if I recall correctly, at the Security Council. They have not taken a position, the same kind of extremist position to that of the United States, incidentally coupled with Australia and Canada, which also, I think, if I recall correctly, voted against that resolution. So that it may well be that this Charlie Hebdo terror attack will be used with a view to twisting France into an unbending support of war crimes committed by the State of Israel. What struck me as well is that in the course of the Paris rally on the following Sunday, you had one member of the Israeli cabinet who was interviewed. He was interviewed on a French TV network, and he was saying very categorically that the Jewish community in France will be looked after by the State of Israel. We will come to your rescue, intimating that if your rights are not protected by the French government, we will come to your rescue. And if you want to come to Israel, you come to Israel. Now, this was interpreted, including by members of the Jewish community in France, as some kind of interference in the affairs of the French Republic, that a foreign power would say, well, we'll come to the rescue of you guys. Okay, I didn't see, Turkey coming to the rescue of the Muslims of France, okay? That would be the analogy. So that the State of Israel comes to the rescue of the Jewish community in France, which is quite significant. And these people don't consider themselves as Israelis, they consider themselves as French. And I think the community itself did react to that kind of insinuation.
French President François Hollande had recently said that the sanctions against Russia should be terminated. Hollande was aligning himself with French economic interests instead of with Washington's foreign policy. Do you think his statement has significance with regard to these Paris attacks?
Well, I think there's certainly, some implications, because Germany toes the line, at least Angela Merkel toes the line. Britain, of course, toes the line because they're part of the Anglo-American axis, and other European countries may not have the clout to go against the U.S. sanctions regime. But although there's a certain amount of opposition, even the Czech, the government of the Czech Republic intimated that these sanctions against Russia were bordering on the absurd. But the thing is that ultimately what the United States intent upon doing is really breaking bilateral trade relations between the European Union and the Russian Federation. And historically, there have always been good relations between Russia and France. They've extended to a whole area of exchanges. So that event in Paris, the attacks on Charlie Hebdo, could be used to realign France into a more sort of kosher, if I could use the expression, a conformist U.S. position, namely that the European Union should support unequivocally the sanctions regime and cease trading with the Russian Federation. And of course, there are very important financial interests underlying that, because the French were selling military equipment to Russia. These were multi-billion dollar contracts. And consequently, what this signifies is that the United States wants to really prevent France from exerting any kind of economic sovereignty. I should mention, and that's very, very important, is that France is no longer an imperial power. And if you look at it historically, the United States has emerged as a major imperial power at the expense of France, largely at the expense of France. We're talking about Indochina, which the French lost their colonies in Indochina, and they lost their sphere of influence in Vietnam and Cambodia. Then, I mean, they're no longer considered as relevant. French used to be spoken in Laos, in Vietnam, in Cambodia, and now those countries are simply their proxy states, their frontiers of the cheap labor global economy. The wages are something like $100 a month. The United States lost the Vietnam War, but in the wake of the Vietnam War and the collapse of the Soviet Union, those former French colonies are now within the U.S. sphere of influence, to the extent that they even have defense cooperation agreements with Vietnam and Cambodia, which are their former enemies. So France is losing its colonies also in North Africa, in West Africa. You can see this happening in Rwanda, which was not a French colony, but it had very close ties to France and Belgium. And then in the wake of the civil war in the 90s, Rwanda from one day to the next becomes an Anglophone country. Okay, it's a kind of a rather weird transition. You know, English is the official language. French is no longer taught in the schools. The university operates in English rather than in French. And there we are. And that is happening in other places. It's happening in Mali. It's happening in Niger, where you have these insurrections. And essentially, there's a conquest of the African continent. Eventually, the presence of France will be weakened, inasmuch as also the French head of state is a proxy. And I would suggest that Sarkozy was a U.S. candidate. There's no question about it. He served U.S. interests. And I would suspect that François Hollande is also towing the line. So all these issues are very much tied together. And indeed, the attacks on Charlie Hebdo, what they have unleashed now is an inquisitorial process, a crusade against Islam, a demonization of the Muslim population of France. Let us not forget, we're talking about 10% of the population, 10% of the population, and a much larger percentage of the population of Paris, because they tend to be concentrated in the periphery of the metropolitan area. So that France's Muslims are being demonized, and this in turn is leading to a situation of chaos, of divisions, of destabilization within a European country. We recall that is how the United States conquers territory. They did it in Yugoslavia. creating divisions between Croats and Serbs. They're doing it in Ukraine. They're doing it they've done it in Syria. They're doing it in Syria and Iraq. And this campaign directed against the Muslim population in Western countries is also based on beating the drums of war, of gaining popular support for a military agenda, a global war on terrorism, a war against those who threaten Western civilization. And it is used to justify a sequence of wars directed against Muslim countries. And that's, of course, that started with September 11, which was immediately followed by an invasion of Afghanistan, barely less than a month later on the 7th of October. And our Western and U.S. military commentators failed to beg the question. You don't plan a large-scale military theater operation thousands of miles away in Afghanistan in a matter of 3 to 4 weeks. Okay? That's the way it was presented to us. That in the wake of 9/11, we're going to wage a war of retribution against Afghanistan, which allegedly had attacked us on September 11, 2001. But that was part of the crusade against Muslims. It started in 2001 because Muslims were allegedly responsible for bringing down the World Trade Center towers.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, who is behind the Paris attacks? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Could the Paris attacks constitute an attack on all of Europe, not just France? That is, the subjugation of all of Europe?
Well, what I've noticed is that in the wake of those attacks, there have been major changes in national security in Britain. The report came in this morning to the fact that internal security has been tightened, that this is going to enable Britain's GC headquarters, which is a domestic spying apparatus, to be granted greater surveillance powers in the wake of the Paris attacks, directed against the Muslim population, but also directed against people who oppose the war or the police state measures, so that there's a whole issue of civil rights, and that this event is going to unleash a sort of fascist tendency within Europe. In effect, the Muslims in the European Union are being targeted in the same way as the Jews were targeted under the Third Reich. They are considered as second-class citizens. They're discriminated against. And the purpose of doing that is really also to harness public opinion in favor of a war, a crusade overseas, of course, against countries in the Middle East. In other words, Muslim countries. And the way you do that is that you say, well, we have our terrorists are here within the homeland, and at the same time we have to go and, of course, wage a peacemaking humanitarian crusade in Iraq, Syria, Algeria, Morocco, Mali, wherever there are Al-Qaeda-affiliated entities, we will be there. Now, it just so happens those Al-Qaeda-affiliated entities, whether it's Boko Haram, whether it is the Islamic State, or Jamaah Islami in Indonesia and Malaysia, all those entities are creations of Western intelligence. And that's fairly well documented. So that the agenda essentially consists in setting these terrorist organizations loose in different countries and then intervening under the pretext that you're coming to rescue these countries. And that's what's happening with Boko Haram in Nigeria at this very moment. Sometimes they are the pretext for intervention, and we can point to the Islamic State or to Boko Haram, or alternatively, they are freedom fighters, and there we can point to Syria in the early period, where the Free Syrian Army was supporting the terrorists, and of course, as you mentioned, Senator McCain was photo-opped together with these jihadist al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists. And so as long as that kind of understanding does not trickle down to public opinion, we're really, I think, we're in an inquisitorial environment. In other words, people don't question the Spanish Inquisition. They don't question the U.S. Inquisition or the French Inquisition. They're accepting, unequivocally accepting without any, nuance, the official version of events. They believe what the media is telling them, or they don't dare to question the consensus underlying these media reports. They are there saying freedom of expression, Charlie Hebdo, je suis Charlie Hebdo, without realizing that Charlie Hebdo precisely has contributed to reinforcing media propaganda and censorship. Because as I mentioned, many of the key events which ultimately indicate the nature of this terrorist attack are simply not made public. And most people in France are not aware of the fact that their own government is supporting the terrorists or the terrorist organizations which are being singled out as responsible for these attacks. So I think what is important is to ask the following question: who are the terrorists? Those who commit the terrorist acts, or those who finance and support the terrorists, namely state-sponsored terrorism? And that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with state-sponsored terrorism, covert operations, and there's ample evidence to that effect, both within Western countries as well as, of course, more visibly in the areas where there's military intervention, e.g. Syria and Iraq, Pakistan, North Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, and beyond.
The terrorist attacks on the comic newspaper in Paris, Charlie Hebdo, has widely been described as a military-style attack. And, of course, in the video, we see these black-covered men. Their faces are covered. We really don't know who these men were. I mean, there's no real evidence who was behind these black masks. Is that correct?
Well, that's certainly correct. There's absolutely no evidence to the fact that these masked men are those three individuals who were killed and who were identified as alleged suspects, other than the fact that they found his ID there just scattered around in the car, in the getaway car. There's absolutely no evidence to that effect. And what I think was revealing is that the first reports pointed to the fact that this was undertaken by gunmen who were very well trained. They were equipped with advanced weapons, Kalashnikov or whatever, and they conducted themselves as if they were special forces. Okay, now, we don't know who they are. We don't know who they are other than the fact that these three suspects have been identified. We don't know anything about them. Now, if we're talking about the sort of official suspects, of course, they're all dead. So they can't tell their story. Now, if we talk about those three suspects, there's all sorts of links to French intelligence and French police. In other words, they've been under the radar of the security and intelligence forces for years. And as I mentioned, one of them actually had a meeting with Sarkozy, okay? So, I mean, of course, I think there are two elements. One has to ask, are these individuals the terrorists that attacked Charlie Hebdo? We don't know, okay? And secondly, assuming they were or they weren't, how is it that these individuals were on the radar of French intelligence and that one of them had actually had a meeting with a former head of state? And is it relevant? Is it relevant that the Paris terror suspect Amadi Coulibaly met French President Nicolas Sarkozy in 2009? It's something which is, in a sense, is somewhat weird. When Amadi Coulibaly, who's the suspect, he's dead now, he had a meeting with Sarkozy. He was greeted by Sarkozy in relation to some kind of employment creation project, okay, where the French president would help people get jobs in a local factory, okay? So for me, it's a very unlikely encounter. Why is it that a French president would meet somebody who is pretty much marginal, unemployed, you know, living in a ghetto, and then that he would say, well, we are going to help him get a job and set up a community project in a Paris suburb, okay? It just doesn't make sense, because if such were the case of the French Republic or the French presidency in assisting employment creation in a French suburb, they wouldn't have a discussion. First of all, the French president wouldn't be involved. It would be some kind of entity, a social welfare entity, which would be involved in that project. No, the meeting took place in 2009. In the Élysée Palace, it's absurd. I mean, what is even more absurd is that nobody mentions it in the French media.
Well, exactly. And you've mentioned the whole hypocrisy of the freedom of expression meme that's being propagated.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if we are to implement freedom of expression, one would expect that French journalists will be allowed to do their job, that they will be allowed to start digging beneath the surface, okay? But that's what investigative reporting is, okay? You dig beneath the surface. You say, what are the political implications of this? The same thing is what we're discussing now, but we're not investigative reporters in France with a mandate to go out and make a fact-finding analysis of what's going on. But essentially, the journalists, what have they done? They have simply waited for the official statements, and they have more or less copied and pasted. Okay. Now, as I mentioned, the case of the suicide of one of the police investigators, the police chief in a major region of France, he commits suicide. Well, their response is simply, we don't talk about it, we don't mention it until 5 days later. And then we say, no, it has nothing to do with it. Well, they didn't even say that. They just described it and pointed to the fact that the police, judicial police, presented condolences. Okay? And now that is the kind of, you know, absence of investigative factual reporting. If a police, you know, if a police investigator de Charlie Hebdo commits suicide a few hours after he is debriefed by his police associates, that is newsworthy. Normally, it should be newsworthy because it has something to do with the event itself, and it has to be revealed. But I suspect that there is some kind of a cover-up, okay? And then the burnout story then becomes the, you know, the new normal there, that, that he was suffering from a burnout because he had met the family of one of the victims. They don't say who that family was. It just so happens it's in a remote region of France. Most of the victims are not from that region. I went through them one by one. They're not from Limoges in the Haute-Vienne, which is, it's really sort of provincial. It's like, you know, Omaha, Nebraska, or something of that order, from the French. It's very far from the metropolis. So, again, it's something to investigate, but they are presenting a story which is an obvious falsification, because their job as journalists would be to go out, go there, find out what happened, and examine the causes of his death. And again, there are so many loose ends in the coverage of Charlie Hebdo, and it's very important that we understand, and that's the key central issue, namely that terrorism is a process which is sponsored by Western governments and their intelligence services. It's called state-sponsored terrorism. And consequently, the state is the instrument behind these terrorists. That is well established. And what the whole Charlie Hebdo process suggests is that the French president and his colleagues from different countries, including the State of Israel, are there to protect the French public against terrorism, when in fact they are covertly supporting those terrorist organizations.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be on the program.
I've been speaking with Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been Who Was Behind the Paris Attacks? Michel Chosadovsky is director of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. The Global Research website, globalresearch.ca, publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis. Michel Chosadovsky is the author of The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, and America's War on Terrorism, as well as co-editor of the anthology The Global Economic Crisis, The Great Depression of the 21st Century. All books are available at globalresearch.ca. That's globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yaro Mako. To leave comments or order copies of shows, email me at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's FAULKNER at GUNSANDBUTTER.org. Visit our transitional website at gunsandbutter.org to sign up for our email list. Follow us at GNB Radio.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Need some inspiration? You're invited to the Western Workers Labor Heritage Festival, January 16th through 18th in Burlingame, California, a celebration of the culture of working women and men. It commemorates Dr. Martin Luther King and the struggle for social and economic justice. The festival offers workshops, films, graphic arts, spoken word, and lots of music, and a concert at 7 p.m. on January 18th. This KPFA-sponsored event is wheelchair-accessible and benefits the Western Workers Labor Heritage Festival. For more information, go to westernworkersfestival.org.
KPFA's annual Grateful Dead Marathon happens Saturday, January 31st from 9 a.m. to 1 a.m. 16 hours of music, talk, fun, and fundraising. I'm David Gans, and I'll be conducting this excursion with some help from Tim Lynch, my co-host on KPFA's Dead to the World. We'll have plenty of great unreleased Grateful Dead music, highlights from live music broadcasts we've hosted over the years, and we'll have a live performance in the studio, too. It's all for the benefit of KPFA, listener-sponsored free speech radio. The KPFA Grateful Dead Marathon.